All right, friends, this is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 150C, page 639, and we are looking at HPB's statements about astrology from the Secret Doctrine. This is a great compendium, this index for cross-referencing great sources concerning the primeval, or as HPB calls it, primitive astrology, which was much greater than our own, much more cosmic than our own, and which was a truly spiritual astrology dealing with the science of relationships, as modern astrology fails yet to do. Note, all the travels of all the heroes of antiquity through the signs of the sun and the heavens are in each individual case the personification of the sufferings, triumphs, and miracles of an adept before and after initiation. Well, I guess we have the greatest example of that in something that DK considered to be really important, even though we have the unfortunate truth that that book could not be completed by the combination of DK and Alice Bailey. It is the Labors of Hercules. And Labors of Hercules. So the heroes are personifications. They are dramatic renderings of the tests and trials and tasks which have to be undergone under the influence of each of these great lords of constellations who are seeing to the building of the human being. The human being being built in its complete 12-foldness, we might say. The 12-foldness represented by the 12-fold zodiacal grouping. Being rounded out, so to speak, with Jupiter as the ruler of the 12th sign, Pisces. Jupiter ruling also the expansion of consciousness and the rounding dynamic within the causal body. I mean, no causal body is like any other, of course. Every causal body has its uniqueness in quality and color and radiation and so forth. But there is generally a fullness which is sought in the causal body. And so we have to go through all of the signs of the zodiac and their rulerships at several different levels and build in a responsive capacity to those much higher energies and thereby attain quality which is stored in some mysterious manner within the causal body. It's stored as vibratory potential that can be evoked or invoked and evoked within the causal body. So I guess Hercules is our great example, and it's presented in such a straightforward manner that we can see the relation of to the signs of the zodiac. So let's just say that Hercules, our best example of such a hero. Heracles, the bright son of Hera, which is, of course, the disciple on his way to becoming radiant, as we all hope to be, as we approach the fourth initiation. The Labors of Hercules, did it take us beyond the fourth initiation, really? Well, maybe not, but in the labors of Aquarius and of Pisces, we might wonder if an initiate beyond the fourth degree perhaps could apply all that he has accumulated to accomplishing this task of cleansing mankind and civilization, the stables of Algides, Algian stables, however that may be pronounced, and of saving humanity, the red cattle of Geryon. The red cattle, because still affected by the red of desire, and therefore unintelligent and subject to their instincts, but still they are being saved by the Piscean Savior. So perhaps we could, you know, go into other mythologies and see how they see whether they have a direct correlation here with the zodiac. I'm thinking of the Kalevala here in Finland, and there are many ways that you can connect the different characters. I can see that, you know, the there is a figure called Ilmarinen. He is a blacksmith. And his connection with Taurus and Vulcan seems pretty clear. There is another figure called Lemminkainen, and he's a Christ-like figure. He's one who expresses love in many ways and on many levels, and there might be a connection with Leo, I'm not sure. Certainly the oldest of the figures, he's called Väinämöinen. He's the Gandalf-like figure. As a matter of fact, Tolkien studied Finnish in order to create the language in The Lord of the Rings called Elfish. Thought that's interesting. And he's a very Capricorn figure. He's an old, old man who is a magician and also a musician. And he represents the spirit, and interestingly enough, the soul of Finland is ruled by Capricorn. So we probably could look in various mythologies, you know, the Wagnerian mythology, to, you know, look to Wotan and Fricka, is it called, and Sigmund, kind of interesting, Siegfried, the hero. Would we find him as Aries? And, you know, Sigmund and Sieglinde, they were brother and sister. Would we find a relation to Gemini? Would we find Siegfried as the soul of Germany, in a way, which is ruled by Aries, interestingly enough? And there's all this imagery about the sword and... of course, he has to rescue Brunhilde from the circle of fire. You can understand what really inspired Wagner to make these great creations and how it captured the attention of the world, and especially of certain exalted but glamorous elements in Germany. The old story goes, my friend Keith told this to me, that maybe it's in the book on music by Cyril Scott, I'm not sure, but the idea that Wagner's music was so transcendent in its own right that the members of the hierarchy wondered how any human being could ever compose such music. I think, you know, he was inspired by great devas, I think. But of course, the music itself was put to uses which inspired National Socialism. So even though it was of the highest kind, the awakening of the reawakening of the Norse gods, which DK said was a definite evil, the reawakening of the ancient gods was rather inspired and furthered by Wagner's music. Maybe even his music was part of that movement towards the reawakening of the ancient gods. So the line between good and evil is very subtle and very sinuous and not always easy to detect. But anyway, the heroes are the sun. They are the sun, and they are the sun going through life experiences and triumphing in those experiences. And the life experiences will relate directly to the zodiacal constellations, at least in our system. I mean, you know, these zodiacal constellations are simply aggregates of solar logoi in our local cosmos system. They probably wouldn't mean much in some other system beyond our local cosmos system. But maybe since they fulfill an archetype of 12 in cosmos, there would be other beings to take their place. The number gods, in a way, seem to be the greatest of all the gods. And the integer gods, I sometimes called them in my infinitization book. The great numbers are the primeval cosmic deities, universal deities, let me say. The 1, the 2, the 3, the 7, the 12. Every number is derivable. And those are the prototypes of all subsidiaries connected with them, including the 12 of our zodiac. There's a much, I would guess, higher 12 than our zodiacal 12. The signs of the zodiac, each a double sign in ancient astrological magic. Namely, it was Taurus Eve. There's the garden, I suppose. And Scorpio was Mars Lupa. Interesting here, the wolf, right? Or Mars and the female wolf. Here we don't have the word Scorpio used, but the name of a planet and a mythological animal figure. So as these signs were opposites of each other, yet met in the center, they are connected. Well, in one way, she's saying something obvious. They were connected, because all oppositions are connected, and these two signs are especially connected, at least in this world period, whatever a world period may be, by a transmission of the fourth ray, and both are deeply connected with desire, with the ending of desire, and with illumination. Now, you kind of wonder here. The female wolf has a good reputation in one sense, that that Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, there's the Rome there, were suckled by a female wolf, I believe. From another point of view, you might wonder whether somehow the instinctual, bestial nature of man is here being represented, and whether it's not another substitute for the dragon, which is the empowerment of the instinctual nature of man. There are all different kinds of ways of representing these ongoingly important lords of constellations who manage to change their the form by which they are represented in each civilization, though they are obviously not changing their stellar spiritual nature. It's just how we see them. Eve is related to the mental plane, we're told. Isis to the astral plane, and Mary with the child to the physical plane. And one wonders about the mental illumination here in relation to Eve, since she encouraged the picking of the apples of knowledge. It's the tree of knowledge, but not the tree of life. So there's something here about Taurus and knowledge. I definitely, because DK really talked about that, its close connection to the acquisition of knowledge. Taurus, Eve, and knowledge. And Scorpio, well, the wolf also has an evil reputation. The packs of wolves, which are very aggressive, this has a good and evil reputation. Evil in the packs of wolves are very aggressive, like the heads of the Hydra. I was reading that there are these huge gray wolves now. Maybe I think there are Canadian gray wolves, but they're now in the state of Idaho in the United States, and they're all out of control in terms of the way they're reproducing. And they are as big as a man and weigh as much as a man. You know, in pounds, 185 pounds, there was this wolf that had been killed and it was held up. It was just as tall as a six-foot man, and they hunt in packs, and they kill for the pleasure of killing and not just to eat. Now that's a bit Hydra-like, isn't it? Well, eventually these symbols by which the great lords of constellations are represented will become ever more adequate. As in the question of the Sabian symbols, as you look at them, you realize that the symbols used for the 360 degrees of the zodiac are very culturally based in the early 20th century. They had meaning for that particular cultural context, and some of them less meaning now. No really adequate symbol, I think, is yet extant for the qualitative nature of and qualitative and energetic nature of each one of the degrees of the zodiac. Each one of those degrees has an energetic specificity, which I think must be scientifically determined. For right now, we simply have the symbols which can give at least an indication. Some of those symbols are really wonderful. Some of them seem a little bit trivial, but a great mind like Dane Rudyard, he got into it and he worked it around so that even the trivial symbols revealed something of value for the person who was working with that, with the energy of that particular degree. Remember, it had to go through the mind of a particular psychic. The fact that it came out in a rather coherent manner is itself remarkable. And Dane Rudyard, in his book, An Astrological Mandala, was able to see the relationships between these symbols in certain series, even though the symbols themselves might seem very, very different. He somehow caught the process that was at work beneath them. But better is to come, and if we can divide a sign into thirds, into sixths, into twelfths, we can certainly divide it into thirtieths in a significant manner, and one day it will be an astro-scientific manner, and we'll know exactly what we're dealing with. I suppose one of the ways to do it, it just occurred to me, is to take to start with the first degree with Aries, the second degree of Aries Taurus, the third degree is Gemini, and so forth, until we would have 30 repetitions of the zodiac by the time we completed the entire round of the zodiac. We could work with that and see if it comes up with anything. The Dwadashamsa, which is the division of the zodiac by 12, does seem to work. You know, the first 2.5 degrees, Aries, the second 2.5 degrees, Aries Taurus, from 5 to 7.5 degrees, Aries Gemini, and so forth. There is a subtone that is found there. Now, what if we were to take, I'm sure this has been thought of before, you know, obviously, and probably the 12 planets, once there are 12, which have been fully defined, will also be capable of being laid out on those degrees. But let's just say that the 12th degree of Aries would be Aries Pisces, the 13th degree would be Aries Aries again. The 24th degree would be, from 23 to 24, so it's really the 24th degree, would be Aries Pisces again. And the 25th degree would be Aries Aries. And so we would end at 30 degrees, we'd be ending at Aries Virgo, and the very first degree of Taurus would be Taurus Libra. Well, you have to have a love of minutiae in order to get into that kind of thing. But one day the energies, detectable energies, will be so fine-tuned that it will be possible to discern the qualities involved even in minute sources. I'm looking forward to that at some point. So anyway, this was HPB's method, or she took it from somebody, where we can relate the signs to each other because of their duality. Now, you know, oftentimes we've forgotten duality. We might almost say that Aries-Libra is a dual process, but that Aries itself is the very masculine side of that, and Libra more receptive, more feminine, except in that it has so many hardline rays connected with it. Nothing is so easily categorizable as we might hope, or dichotomizable, if I can say that. It seems that reality will confound us when we try to lay out a mental map on reality. From reality should arise such maps as we can use, and not maybe the other way around. But I suppose there is a way to look at the positive and negative of every sign, and to work out the invocation and evocation, invocational and evocational processes of astrological magic accordingly. I think the principle is clear, though. We're looking for double signs. There are double planets, really. If the, you know, and it's just obvious, but if the moon is the principle of the feminine, why is there the so-called man in the moon? And HBB points out that Venus had a beard. So we could go looking for the polarities. It may be the truly androgynous planet or neutral planet, which is neither masculine or feminine, although he is a boy-like masculine figure, is Mercury. But maybe we can find the male and female. We certainly, this is the whole question of the, let's call it, the consorts of the gods. Now, in Buddhism, this is very pronounced. And this is maybe every city has its Shakti, or every deity has its Shakti. We can put it that way. So there's always the female power associated. We do not escape duality. And even in the soul, we have, this time with Mercury representing the masculine, we have Hermes Aphrodite. So we have the Hermes Aphrodite, the hermaphrodite. We have the male and female potencies within the soul. And I suppose that that is very appropriate. I mean, it is both the soul as that which assertively gathers impression, and the soul as that which receives impression. It's like the search for impression and the attraction of impression. I'm trying to put this in terms of consciousness. Well, there are all kinds of relations in the great science of relations, and we sometimes have some pretty crude ways of representing these things. Now, here are some references in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. We do go back to the secret doctrine. Some of these I may have referred to along the way. And, you know, I begin to wish it had been possible to treat A Treatise of on Cosmic Fire in this less formal, more conversational manner. It would be a long series of programs, and I don't know if I have time in my life to do that, but I'd almost like to go back and do that. For about 1,000 or 1,100 pages, I was fairly meticulous in writing these Cosmic Fire commentaries for the group called the Fellowship of Cosmic Fire. But, you know, it's difficult to free associate when you are trying to put things exactly into words. And many ideas escape. Of course, the clarity of the presentation is greater, but ideas escape, which otherwise could be captured, Well, they are captured by words and thoughts rather than by thoughts and writing, let us say. So, you know, if I had another 30 years living to be 100, like, you know, I would do that kind of thing and try to offer those tendrils of connection, as I described earlier. Until the mystery of the Great Bear is revealed and is known as it is, which obviously we don't know yet, do we? I mean, to be told it's the head center and the one about whom naught may be said, the seven head centers, and until the influence of the Pleiades is comprehended and the true significance of the cosmic triangle formed by the seven rishis of the Great Bear, the seven planetary logoi of our system, and the seven Pleiades or sisters is revealed, the karma of the seven sacred planets will remain unknown. So in this relationship lies the mystery of the karma. Now we're told ours is not one of the seven sacred planets, our Earth, but we are told that there is much of the karma of personality in the present expression and the history of our planetary logos. Of course, DK put it better and differently, but that's the idea, that there is not yet the solution of the problem of personality, and that problem of personality is part of the karmic legacy of our particular planetary logos. But here we have these great prototypes. The seven stars of the Great Bear are prototypes of the seven seven sacred planets, and the seven stars, major stars of the Pleiades, bestow Manus upon them. We know that Manus is ruled by Saturn and the third ray and is directly related to karma. So we have here the idea of conditions, which is ray 3, Saturn, karma, and the will to overcome those conditions found in the will aspect of the rays, of the seven rays, as transmitted by the seven rishis. What does it take to overcome karma? Of course, there's also the balancing factor of love, but when you see a condition which has to be changed, it is what has existed because of what we have done. There's the activity aspect, third ray. Then we have to apply our focused will to repattern that condition. So, so much of the planetary lore is not understood. We understand something about Venus's progress through the solar system as the most rapidly unfolding planet, even if not the planet of highest spiritual status. We understand something about its rays, and probably there is implied a great relation with the star Sirius. Very little is given about our planet, except that we were retarded through a failure during this solar system, yes, but during the moon chain of our planetary expression, just as we are in the Earth chain now. We understand that the Earth is, in a way, closely related to cosmic kundalini, that a great station of light will be released here on Earth. So much of human progress has to be understood in terms of light and even planetary progress. So we will become a sacred lighted sphere when we are a sacred planet, and especially when our solar logos is passing through a fourth or fifth initiation where the base of the spine center is so very important to awaken. But there are little hints here, and probably in mythology there are some hints, at least about theogony, you know, about the birth of the gods. But there's more about the birth of the gods than about the destiny of the gods, wouldn't you say? So there is more, there is more about the birth of the gods than the destiny of the gods. Do we need to understand the karma of, what does karma mean here? These are chakras of the solar logos, the planets are. And it fits very well with emanation theory. You know, in a way, they are not themselves. They are themselves and yet are not themselves. They are aspects, well, all monads are one. They are, in a way, aspects of the monad of the solar logos. Monads create chakras, don't they? So, the you know, around 169 of cosmic fire, it becomes pretty clear that the energy which creates chakras is coming from the monadic nature. So they are sent forth from the sun, but in a way they are also retracted. Now you say, well, they didn't appear that way on the physical plane. Well, maybe not, but maybe the emanation of their spiritual principles from the sun occurred on subtler planes. So that by the time they appear in the dense physical, they look like comets. They look like separate entities, and yet they have been sent forth by a greater being. And you know the chart that I would refer to here. This is it. It shows that every being is really somehow an emanation of a still greater being. And if we have a sun, it's going to be an emanation, along with six other major suns, of a still greater type of logos, and on and on and on. How far, we do not know. I don't know if this particular map has any reasonable end to it. Well, there are 10 dimensions in cosmos, we are told. We don't know how big those dimensions really are, or where they should begin, but, you know, perhaps we go from systemic to cosmic to supercosmic to super-supercosmic and so forth. And really, we're in no position to even think beyond the cosmic levels, and there are implications that there are supercosmic levels if we consult the, for instance, the origin of the solar angels. They've already been to the cosmic astral plane in order to be schooled on Sirius. So where do the solar angels have their monad? If they've already gone forth from the monadic level at maybe, let's say, the fifth initiation in a previous solar system, are there monads perhaps on the cosmic astral plane? So, you know, when we have a when we have a great solar angelic being who serves as the solar angel for a solar logos, maybe its monad is on the supercosmic astral plane, and so forth. You could just keep on multiplying these planes. It would be good mental gymnastics, but it couldn't lead anywhere, because all we would be doing is expanding according to the law of analogy. Anyway, we're not going to... Let's just say that one of the rishis and one of the stars of the Pleiades, major stars of the Pleiades, is connected with each one of the sacred planets. Each one of them forms a triangle. And in the adjustment of that triangle, let's say, in the adjustment of those triangles formed by a star of the Great Bear, one of the Pleiades, and a sacred planet, lies the story of the spirit-matter relationship on those planets. So obviously some need adjustment. And maybe Saturn has got to be one of those planets that has a star from the Great Bear and a star from the Pleiades, and we are directly responsive to Saturn since it is the head center of this great third-ray being. Do we ourselves here on Earth have a direct connection with the same two sponsoring stars that sponsor Saturn, because it's all along the third-ray line? And would we change our sponsors when we move to our second-ray soul? There are questions there about the prototypes, both in will and intelligence, from the Great Bear and the Pleiades, and whether they relate to a planet based upon its personality rays, soul ray, or monadic ray. These are some of the intricacies which lie ahead when we go to truly understand systemic and cosmic interrelationships. We're not in a position to do that yet. And nor are we in a position to understand the karma, but maybe a little bit of the lore through mythology. I would say the best way to understand at the moment is, let's say, understand through the lore, through mythology. How about spelling? All that we can see is it's working out in the solar system. We don't know the original karmic relationship even between the Great Bear and Pleiades, and there's some lack of adjustment there, probably related to the third ray into matter, which is causing, which is one of the conditioning factors in making cosmic evil as it affects our system possible. The intricacy of the whole subject will be apparent when it is borne in mind that not only do these three groups form a cosmic triangle, but within that triangle, many lesser triangles have to be studied. And, you know, like, you know, as I said before, let's just say, give you an idea, and I think you can take it from here, something like Bennett, Nash, Alcyone, and Vulcan, at least at the present time, because Vulcan is a first-ray soul planet, and there are no other sacred planets which are first-ray soul planets, and so since we're in a solar system, Vulcan might be just the one to be connected. Later, if we were in a monadic system, a first-ray system, it might be Bennett, Nash, Alcyone, and Uranus. Or in the future, the Earth, possibly, with its first-ray monad. And then we could, you know, we could look at something like this. We could say Mizar, and then what is the second-ray star in the Pleiades, whichever one it is it Electra? And then Jupiter, like that. And we would have to have a pretty good assignment. Now, Nicholas and I did this in class. I mean, there's no, we had our reasons, but there's no complete certainty about the ray assignments. All we know is that it's very likely that there are ray assignments, major ray assignments, for the seven stars. I mean, Maya, you know, would it be a third ray star? We had this all worked out, and I could go dig for it, but I think the principles are present. If you want to get, you know, Nicholas Nilén's idea about which are the ray assignments for the Pleiades, you know, just get in touch with him, and I'm sure he'd be happy to teach you or to, you know, have a class where you could learn something of that nature. I'm going to pause just for a moment. I think it would be very possible for us to look closely at the Pleiades. Here they are, Taygete, Electra, Alcyone, Sterope, Seleno, Maya, Merope, and try to determine their ray correlations. Obviously, The central one, Alcyone, is the first ray. But this is, well, there are so many wonderful documents on the internet. And I'll just say that going through these, it might be possible for us to make some sort of theory concerning them. Look at this. The Pleiades, whose stars are these lovely Taygeta. Does that have to do with the fourth ray? And dark-faced Electra. What ray is that? And Alcyone and bright Asterope. There's possibly a connection there with the fifth ray, the brightest of all, Seleno, Maia, Merope. Different things are said about each one of these Pleiades. Atlas fathered her, Maia, outstanding in beauty among his seven dear violet-haired daughters, who are called the heavenly Pleiades. So the connection to the seventh ray and to the matter aspect is very strong. But Maia is said to be of outstanding beauty. And it's said of Maia elsewhere that she is the good nursing mother. What does that tell us? So I think, you know, research will need to be done here. And I think hints can be picked up about their nature. Now, the nature is not looked at uniformly. Is not looked at uniformly by all the different authors. Some are poetic. You see, here we have some names. Maia, the good nursing mother, Taygete of Mount Taygetus. We can't tell too much there. Sterope, I suppose, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But Sterope and Asterope have to do with this release of light. Merope is usually the Pleiad who hid her face in shame because she married a mortal, Sisyphus. On that high level, a mortal could easily be a non-sacred planet, such as our Earth. Alcyone's strong helper, there's the first ray, obviously. Electra is amber-colored and Seleno black or dark, but this is just one of the descriptions, and there are, let's see here. Okay, the Pleiades. Okay, let's come back there. Maybe not, huh? The Pleiades described, star myth. Okay, I'm trying to, there they are. Okay. Maybe this is a document that you all would like to, read something about and see if it would be possible to determine the nature of the different Pleiades in terms of their ray structure. We can probably come up with reasons for all this. Well, here we are again at that little chart that I showed. Strong helper, black, dark, etc. Each one of them will have their own character. And in the poetry of the ancient Greeks, they have been discussed, their relationship to the Hyades as well. Merope wed to Sisyphus bore Glaucus, who as many say was the father of Bellerophon. Bellerophon, okay. Others say Electra does not appear because the Pleiades are thought to lead the circling dance for the stars. But she left them. Okay, so different character is revealed. And probably the character of each should be put forth and the many references compared. The seventh Merope wed you, mortal Sisyphus. She regrets it and hides alone in shame. She was discovered relatively late in the process. And we have here the relationship to Troy, but that is a more modern connection. Well, anyway, I'm going through these. I was ever born myself I was ever born myself one of those Pleiades, seven girls whom our mother once carried under her heart in labor, seven times having called Eilithyia at her lying, caught having called Eilithyia at her lying, in to lighten the pangs of birth after birth. I am witness, for my house, if far from my father's, no Sterope is near me, no Maia my companion. Some factor of isolation is here. No sister Kaleno beside me at my hearth. I have not danced up and down. Sister Tygetes Lacedaemon at my breast, nor held the merry boy on my cherished arms. Some isolation. I do not see Alcyone's house hard by, or hear Merope herself speak some heart-warming word. What Ray would speak the heart-warming word. I feel a comfortable hope by the promises of Zeus that with my other sisters I shall pass from the earth to the stars' Atlantean vault and dwell in heaven myself, a star with my sisters six. But there is a factor of isolation here, and why is that? And what Ray would give it? Well, it's a big research project, isn't it? You know, and I suppose you can somewhat freeze the screen and perhaps see, if not print, the various things that are here. These are references from various authors in antiquity. And here we have it. Hesiod, Pindar, Greek lyric, Aeschylus, Apollodorus, Philostratus, Ovid, Seneca, they would have had the myths near at hand. All right, so, you know, do we know? Here they are, arranged in order. Atlas and Pleione off to the side. Alcyone, very central, strong helper. Merope, we've heard of heart-warming words. Electra carrying some degree of isolation. Maia with the name Nourishing Mother. Asterope with the flashing face. Sterope and Asterope. And Tygete, she was said to be lovely. We have to know how much of this is poetic license and how much of it relates to the mythology of these stars. All right, well, a great deviation there, perhaps. Let's see, I just have to find where we are, the esoteric astrology. There we are. Okay. So, when it comes to finding out what is the second ray star, you know, first, the second ray star in the Great Bear is Mizar, but could it be Maia with her strongly nourishing tendencies, and would this then be related somehow to Jupiter or to another second-ray planet? But this is the one, Maia. Okay, could it be that? Could it be Maia? It certainly doesn't seem to be Electra, who is also not only considered to be amber-colored, which interestingly enough is related to orange. Ah, of course. Isolation and electricity, Electra. Electra could be Ray 5. Could be. The isolation factor. On the other hand, the flashing face. See, where do we have the duality? The duality we have with Sterope and Asterope. We have to find the Ray 6 star as well. Well, here they are. Could this be the second ray star? Where would the third ray star be found? Could it be connected with Merope? And yet, the marrying of the mortal seems rather earthly. It is certainly possible. When we have two, can it in some respect represent the duality of the fourth ray? We have to find specific qualities for each of these, and that's a big research project. But I've gone through this document, which looks quite good with its quotes from various of the Greek writers, and maybe someone would like to undertake that. Let's see, I'm going to make sure that this is, yeah, Ray 5, let's see. Now let's see, Steropé and Asteropé are dual, Ray 4, and yet they have the flashing face. Oh yes, Electra has this amber quality, orange, possibly Ray 5. Well, I could take it further. It would take the entire time, and it would be a days-long research project. So I just pointed out to you as a possibility, and you, as I say, you can consult with Nicholas regarding his estimation of this assignment. But I think what is important is to realize that if there are seven stars in the Great Bear that convey these rays, and the seven sisters are really the seven wives of the seven rishis, they are going to have a ray correspondence too. And the Benet Nash Alcyone, we know this is the Ray 1 star in the Great Bear, and Alcyone is the strong helper in the center of everything, very likely the central star, the Ray 1 star. Then we'd have to look for the sacred planet with which these two might be connected. It would be Vulcan, and we'd have to do the same for all once we assign the Pleiades properly. Any one of the seven rishis with one of the seven sisters may form a subsidiary triangle, and all must thus be studied. So, you know, he's laying out for us a future of brilliant study that can really lead to revelation. But this for the future schools, I guess. We can study the lore of these sisters, but we will not be able to relate them to the Ray language and to occultism, and that's where the study comes in, to enable us to do this. Okay. Well, these secret doctrine references lead off in many directions. A further factor in cyclic computation lies in the effect of the following stars and constellations upon our system. I suppose that's the important part, that they have an effect upon our system and upon any particular planet within the system. So the Great Bear, Little Bear, you know, first and second ray in a way. The pole star, part of the Little Bear, the tail of the Little Bear. The Pleiades, so central to everything, and Capricorn here, isolated from all the other constellations. It's the only one of the zodiacal constellations which is isolated in this way, and the great constellation Draco, which operates between the Great Bear and the Little Bear. You see, the dragon is between the two. The great dragon is said to be connected with Cosmic Kundalini, related to the seventh ray, and somehow a connecting factor, I suppose, in all of this. He has a base of the spine center function. The only single star in all of this is the pole star, probably because it's so important now in relation to our Earth, and it will not be later. It may be the first ray star in the Little Bear. But the Little Bear has the aspect of the Son, S-O-N, connected with it, and not the Father. So it carries a kind of a second ray, fifth ray meaning. And in that, it's very much like Sirius and very much like Venus. Sirius is the home of Manus, at least on its soul level, but it's also the cosmic Christ, second ray and fifth ray. Venus is, we know, a fifth-ray soul, but a sixth-ray monad, and you can't have a final sixth-ray monad. So it's more likely that the higher monadic ray in this case is the second ray. The Great Bear is the son of the Father, therefore the second ray. But if you check the Tetractys, it's the fifth dot, 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, it's the fifth dot that's immediately under the first. So there is a connection here with the fifth ray and with the Ajna Center. And Polaris is the guiding star. And so connecting it with the Ajna Center, I think, would be reasonable. Sometimes when I've thought about this, it seems to me that the Little Bear should not necessarily represent the heart center. It could possibly, but it could easily connect with the Ajna Center with its major guiding star. Of course, if the Little Bear did somehow connect with the heart center, then we'd have to find what we meant by the Ajna Center. And immediately, I suppose, Sirius A and B would become candidates. But if Sirius is also connected with the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, it might have its place within that configuration. And that configuration could easily be a solar plexus. Of course, there are some who insist that Orion is the solar plexus, and there is a basis for that because of the way Betelgeuse is used as a blind for Orion, and how the those on the path of the planetary Logoi pursue a path to Betelgeuse, and how they are connected with the third ray. There is a possibility there. And, you know, the brightness of a constellation will tell us something about the stage of development in which the logos in which it is found has reached. Can it be that the solar plexus is the most developed? It is really a tremendously developed center. If Orion is the solar plexus. Then, of course, we have to find the sacral center. That could be problematic. The base of the spine is Draco. We do have a seven solar systems, of which ours is one. And we do have Taurus and Scorpio connected with it, and Mars. They both have a strong sacral energy, but the whole question of desire is particularly related to our seven solar systems, to the seven solar systems of which ours is one. So let's just say that the Great Bear is the seven it's the seven centers in the head of the one about whom naught may be said, either in or above, as I've been trying to say. And the Little Bear is very close. The head center itself may well be the entirety of the Pleiades with all of those stars, you know, the many, many stars. And the jewel box of the seven major Pleiades could be that jewel in the center of the heart and the head of the one about whom naught may be said. I know it seems hopelessly remote. I would say that the last word in arranging these constellations, there are many good theories, but I would say the last word has not been offered. I would say our seven solar systems, the immediate ones around our sun, are good candidates for the solar plexus. But that cannot be if Orion is the solar plexus. But if Orion were the heart center, then we'd have to bring the Little Bear up into the Ajna area, which I think is reasonable. And as I've said before, the two stars, there's two major centers in a solar plexus. And it could be Sirius and our sun, or Sirius A and Sirius B. Perhaps Sirius and our sun would be two major points within a solar plexus. Every chakra is going to have seven major centers. That seems to be the analogy, because every chakra is a constellation. So I'm still liking the arrangement of the Pleiades having to do with the great head center in the one about whom not may be said. We still need the throat, of course, and the question is what constellation could play that, not the entirety of the Pleiades, I think, not the entirety of it, maybe a part of it. We'd have the great bear as the seven head centers, the higher head centers, either within or above the head. We'd have Orion as the heart center, the little bear as the Ajna center, and we'd have our constellation as the solar plexus center. We'd have the base of the spine center being Draco. We still have to consider the sacral center, and we have wondered whether the centaur could not be considered that sacral center, the constellation of the centaur. But this is not written in stone. Of course not. So there are, there are movements and cyclic computation. Let's take a look, a further factor in cyclic computation. Let's go there and see what's the context. A further factor in cyclic computation. There's going to be two contexts. The first is in cosmic fire. He's dealing with it here on page 797. And by the time the seventh round is reached, the evil effect of the then moon, which will have, to all intents and purposes, practically disappeared, will be finished. During the fifth round, men will discover how to neutralize any remaining effects through scientific achievement and knowledge of the necessary sounds and mantras, and thus much evil will be offset. The etheric moon is included in these remarks. The greatest effect of the moon conditions is to be seen working out preeminently in the terror and present distress in the animal kingdom. Well, we must have been dealing with cyclic computation a little bit higher. Here we go. Figures must also be computed when the effect of the planets on what is called the asteroids is known. The true figures in connection with any planetary scheme and its occult activity are not ascertainable by man. The figures for the planets concerning the inner round differ as to length and time. So this whole section here in 7, it's about timing. And he's simply saying that these factors of the Great Bear, Little Bear, Pole Star, especially where our planet is concerned, the Pleiades, the constellation Capricorn, Sirius, and the various constellations of the zodiac, see, not all of this has been included, and it should be, in this reference where we are. Only some things have been included, and now I want to write in a different color, and smaller if I can. The more full version of this. So this is TCF, and it's 795, I guess. 795, yeah. So other factors are also involved here in the cyclic computation. All the other constellations and allied stars of the zodiac, and all the other constellations and allied stars. Okay. The mystery is hidden in esoteric astrology until the subject of energy working through the etheric body, of radioactivity, and of the transmutation of all bodies from the lower state into the higher is better comprehended. The true mystery of the influence of these various bodies upon each other will remain at its present stage an unrevealed secret. Well, at least we see the different bodies, the different heavenly bodies, which are all involved with each other and which play a role in determining important cycles and durations of cycles. And so, interestingly, Capricorn is singled out. Here, notice in the six that are given, on page, what is it, 6, what is it, 640-something here, some of these are left out of the picture. Well, look, I think I've gone far enough for the moment here. This will be the place where I will have to say that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 150C. And we are in page 641, it looks like. It looks like page 641. And we will, beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 151A, page 641. It looks like this is quite a cosmic section, dealing with things in general, dealing with mysteries that we cannot really fathom, but maybe little hints will appear which will be of use to us. The etheric body holds the key, and the study of the transmission of energies and the becoming radioactive of the etheric centers are going to tell us a lot about the stages of evolution of the stars, their degree of development, hence their radioactivity, the same of constellations, because there's a constant transmutation going on, raising all into a state of radioactivity. So what is the influence of these various bodies upon each other? Well, there may be some influence which has to do with motion, but there's also going to be an influence which has to do with elevation and maybe, who knows, even of retardation. So they will affect the vibratory. Let's call these things vibratory effects. All right, I think that's far enough for the moment, and we're in the land of speculation here, folks. HPB is drawing very big picture, giving us a kind of overview, and then DK comes in with cosmic fire, and it becomes even more vast. We do want to realize, as we look into the heavens, that there are great intelligences and beings who are expressing through the various stars and constellations. They're all one part of one great being, but they have different purposes and qualitative effects. And we in this solar system are certainly being influenced by them. We're being guided in our the qualities of energy we express through the Great Bear. The Little Bear is proving to be orienting. The Pole Star is a great star of orientation at this time on the Earth. The Pleiades seem to be sponsoring everything. The constellation Capricorn is leading to the possibility of elevation. The law of elevation is ruled by Capricorn, hence to initiation. Draco is speaking of the rising of the Kundalini so that we can all become lesser dragons of wisdom who are the masters and one day full dragons of wisdom. Great things are happening up there and in here because all of this pervades us. Well, I'm certainly being a little less careful about these hour longs, so I'll just ask my colleague Brett to do what he can with this, and maybe I'll recover and stick to the hour as much as possible in the next discussions. Okay, we'll see you a little later, and with 151A.